everyone. Thank you for being here. It is my pleasure to introduce Charlotte Houghton, Associate Professor of Art History, just across the way. And we talked about doing this, gosh, several months ago.
Yeah, quite a while.
And had a great time thinking about paper tigresses and strong women. And
oh, I forgot I had a title. I should have put it up.
It's been all over the radio, all over WPSU. I kept hearing it. I don't know if anybody else did, but anyway. Thank you very much for being here, and I'm going to turn it over to Charlotte. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you. Thank you all for coming. I'm so pleased to see everybody. I was thrilled when Joyce approached me about the idea of perhaps giving a putting together a little exhibition in the context of the Judy Chicago Spring that we're having. And I immediately realized that even though Judy Chicago lives now about 500 years after anything I know about, that in the period I do study, there developed in the visual arts a very strong set of images along a certain theme. And for anyone who doesn't understand the word topos, which I didn't when I started studying art history, it is exactly a theme or a conventional sort of categorization of individuals like the nerdy chemist or the femme fatale or that sort of thing. And that topos involved various iterations of the idea of the power of women, which today we think of, or at least most of us in this room, I would assume, think of, where are the men? Yeah, that's their role. That's good.
Do I have to leave?
Only for a part. We'll let you know. Which in our period, I think, is a very positive idea, the power of women. We all want to be empowered. In the 1400s and the 1500s, this was a very scary societal idea. And I think both for men and for women, that women who were too powerful inverted the social order. And so a group of images that spotlighted very powerful women developed. And even though these had already existed in literature to some extent, it was really in the 1400s that they began to filter into visual art. And we could talk about why, but I'm not going to go there at this point. Before I start talking about the power of women, I want also to thank both Joyce and Catherine Koltiska, both of whom have helped me throughout this, and Patrick, who helped me arrange things yesterday. And so without their help, I'd sort of be like, what am I going to do here? All right. The one other thing I want to say is that I do specialize in artwork of the 15th, 16th, early 17th centuries. And there's a bunch of that over in that corner and one over here. Most of the rest of the images are 20th and 21st, maybe just 20th century. And I'm not an expert in that, neither in the artwork and artists, nor in the various media of the later period. And so the best I can do for you here is to talk about how some of the earlier themes that I'm discussing, introducing you to, have found new manifestation in the 20th century, either expressing a kind of fear or expressing a more subversive idea of it. And so I'm also hoping that either while I'm speaking or afterward, that especially Karen Kiefer-Boyd and Joyce and whoever else wants to jump in can perhaps dive deeper into some of the areas that I'm not so equipped to. Okay, so let me just begin. I have a few slides, not many. I want to begin with a few just to introduce you to the theme of the power of women. And when this theme developed, it really was about the negative power of women. Okay? Because, of course, it all started with Eve. And it was her, you know, God made her that way. But anyway, let's not go there. It was really her first wiles, her tricking Adam into eating that apple, that began all of our problems, of course. And she was the mother of a race of women who also had borne into them the sinfulness of Eve and the treachery. And so that is the idea that comes to the fore in this sort of series. So originally, the set of themes, the set of stories that illustrated this were, among others, Aristotle and Phyllis. All right? And this is the story of the wise philosopher Aristotle, who is wise and able to be the most insightful in all things, the one who basically arranges the world in categories and sets up ideas about ethics and things like that. And yet he became so besotted by a young woman that he was willing to let her ride him horseyback around while his pupil, Alexander the Great, was watching. All right. Now, I can't tell you how negative an image this was. The idea that in any realm of experience, the woman might be on top, and take that in any place that might, was anathema. And indeed, in the place you were just thinking of, it was illegal. Okay. And so this idea that women can turn even the wisest men into fools was a very powerful one at the time. And then each of these is in some way related to that. This is Solomon being persuaded to bow down to idols that were not, obviously no idol is God, idols that were outside the Jewish faith at the time. It was a very negative scene. Samson having his hair cut by Delilah, of course. Salome, who cajoled Herod into promising her anything she wanted if she would dance for him. So there again, this sort of being sexually overpowered. And then Herod being horrified that when she says what she wants, it turns out to be the head of John the Baptist on a platter. Okay, that being revenge for his having spurned her, not being interested in her. One of my favorites is this one, which is the scene of Virgil in a basket. Okay, and the writer Virgil, very much like Aristotle, was highly respected, and his writings and Cicero's writings were really the basis of the burgeoning Latin humanism that was pervading Europe at this time. And so Virgil, again, one of the very wisest and most important of authors, fell in love with a woman, and she said to him, "Okay, listen, come under my window at night under the cover of darkness, and I will put down a basket, and you get in it, and I will bring it up to my room." And so he gets in the basket, and he looks up at her, and she brings it up halfway up the tower and leaves him hanging, so that the next morning, everybody comes out and sees him, right? A fool. So this was probably the most frequent illustration of this idea, but this was a very frequent one, too. So all of these are extremely negative. But it's interesting that the power of women for good could be scary as well. Because they weren't the ones in the proper order who should be performing some of the sorts of tasks that we're going to see them performing. This is one example of, a number of the women who get folded into the Power of Women series are actually, they're virtuous, and what they're doing is something that is helping in most cases, the Israeli people, the Jews of the time of the Old Testament. And yet, even with their positive associations, their power gets caught up in this set of sort of scary scenarios. This is Yael and Sisera, a woman, Sisera being someone who was negative toward the Israelites, and she manages to get him, give him a sleeping potion, and many of these are continuous narratives, give him a sleeping potion here, and when he's asleep, she takes a tent pole and smashes it through his head until it drives into the ground. Okay, she's a heroine, but this idea was still a little discomforting to men at the time. Let me just go on for a moment. Of course, another of these sorts of this is a negative one again. The image of Lot and his daughters. Lot and his daughters who flee Sodom and Gomorrah. Lot's wife who turns back to look and turns into a pillar of salt. And then Lot and the daughters sally forth, and the daughters, wanting to be able to continue the line, seduce him through drink again and do continue the line. I'm not going to talk a lot about this image. There's a lot we could say about it, but suffice it to say that a number of these images created the opportunity not only for sort of moral reprimand, but also for very salacious looking. So the audience was able to kind of get it both ways in these images. Okay. Now, these works were often sold as a series. And in the first images we looked at, four of those were by Lucas van Leyden, who created a set specific Power of Women series to sell. This is by a German artist named Peter Flirtner from about 1535, and it includes Aristotle and Phyllis, Solomon and the Idols, David watching Bathsheba, and Samson and Delilah, so they could be made together. One of those women who became who was both a positive model and a very fear-inspiring figure was Judith, who beheaded Holofernes. I'm going to talk about that more in a moment because we have a fantastic example of that story in our collection. But this shows her in the midst of doing that. Now, these also were common household themes to be placed on objects. And one of my favorite examples of this is this little salt cellar, beautifully enameled, Limoges, actually, salt cellar, that is hexagonal. And on each side, there is another one of these scenes in the theme. So Adam and Eve, Solomon, there's Virgil in his basket. This is Hercules being overcome, I believe. Yes, it's another one of these inversion stories. Hercules wanted to expiate a crime that a friend of his committed, and he was ordered to allow the queen, Omphale, to make him her slave for a year. And what she did was have him do all the spinning for her. And for a man to spin was so infra-dig, I just can't tell you. I mean, this was just a very unmanly thing to do, so that's what's going on here. And here we have Yael, and there's Phyllis writing Aristotle. So, and you can imagine that as a conversation piece on the dinner table. You turn it this way. This is from the 1570s or so. It's not big. It's, you know, this big. For those of you who know about that era of art, it sort of makes me think of Moses Well of Klaus Sluter on a slight, on a different theme, you know, turning around on your table.
Then would this be owned by the woman of the house or the man of, I mean, who would be the audience?
Right. Well, that's a very interesting question. Of course, men and women were both audiences for these. They were generally cautionary tales created by men for men to either look at or offer to women as, this is what you shouldn't do, right? But one can also imagine a feisty woman having at this theme along with her husband and others and, you know, trying to embrace it. So we don't exactly know, but that's a really good question, certainly. And this, there also was a very humorous flip side. Well, it isn't a flip side, but a humorous side to these sorts of images. And they always involved an inversion of the power scheme between men and women, right? Because that was the real issue here. It was not violence. It was not even sexual wiles in themselves. It was not sin. It was when women have more power than men, and that is an inversion of the natural world. And so this, for instance, is by... I'm sorry, what? This is a very good example from the late 1400s, a print by Israel von Meckenem. It's a satirical family shield, right? And you see the woman riding the man, and not only is she riding him, he's holding her distaff, her spinning device. That's bad in itself. She's riding him backwards, which is what witches did on things like flying goats, okay? And she's sitting on top of him. So in all those ways, this is a real problem. And then just, you know, as if that isn't clear enough, there's someone literally upside down here. So it's obviously the world upside down. And these could get pretty pretty raunchy. They were often a lot of fun. I sort of wonder how this was used, if something was in it. And, you know, it would be, the dinner would be served to the man, and as he ate, he'd go, oh, wow. So... Okay, I'm going to leave that up for your delectation while I start to talk about a few of the works here. Actually, I'm not going to start over there. I'll get to that in a minute, because I wanted to talk about some of the more contemporary manifestations of the power of women. And of course, I've been talking about the negative and power relationship sort of image, but I wanted to start with the concept of the icon, which I think is very powerful today in our society. And I wanted to start with, and I'm going to try to keep these remarks relatively brief so you can get up and look at these images, because that's the whole point. I wanted to start with the Virgin Mary, with our exquisite little engraving. It's actually an etching and engraving, which, if you know about printmaking of the time, this is very unusual. There was not a lot of etching being done in the 1400s, 1500s, but Dürer did experiment with it a few times. And it's primarily an engraving by Dürer of the Virgin and Child being crowned by an angel. It's a beautiful print. It's a nice exemplar of the print. And what I want you to do when you come look at it is really examine the line, the quality of the line, the nature of the engraving of it. Because Dürer has a quite linear style of engraving. And through that, he is able to create some marvelous, very silvery tones. There isn't a lot of curve in his lines, which is something that is quite representative of prints, engravings made in the 15th and 16th centuries, into the middle of the 16th century. We're going to get to some prints a little later on that have a very different technique, and I'd like you to have a chance to contrast those and see how different they are. And so we jump quite a while into the 1960s with this, I think, wonderful evocation of Barbra Streisand, which is called Girl from Brooklyn, Three Quarters Front. What I think is what I like about the title is that it assumes that you know who this is. I mean, this person is so iconic that she doesn't have to be named for you to represent her. Now, for how much longer that would be true, I don't know. And in fact, there probably are a number of people in this room who say, huh? Oh, it is? You know? who is she? Yeah. And by the way, she is a singer who was particularly famous in the 1960s. And one of the wonderful things about her becoming an icon is that she was a really Jewish girl with a big nose. And that was not the musical comedy type of the 1960s. And she really broke ground here. And so this and this was made in the 60s. And so there's something really special about that as well. But the art historian in me wants to make sure you understand that one of the ways this functions is by drawing upon you to, on some level, associate this with other images of powerful women. And particularly, I just brought in a couple that I thought were apposite. Nefertiti, who goes back to, 1350 BC or something like that. And a figure that comes in between, which is obviously drawing on this figure, is John Singer Sargent's Madam X from the, I think it's 1880s, yeah, about then. And so you really have a continuum both of the sense of the power of the icon and of the continuous reference, art historical reference in these works. All right, I'm going to go quickly through some of these. The next is an interesting print that I hadn't known before I was looking for works here. This is Salvador Dalí's print. It's a color engraving from 1968, and it's called Much Ado About Shakespeare, Cleopatra. So we move from Nefertiti to Cleopatra. And the next is Andy Warhol's Chris Evert. And I'm so thrilled that we have this photograph. I mean, this is a one-off Polaroid photograph of Chris Evert. I don't know, how long will this last?
Depends on how long we keep it in the light.
Might turn her around right now.
They're not terrible.
Yeah, I know. I mean, I think of my family's Polaroids of me when I was a tiny child, and they're all sort of silver and black now, which probably just as well. this is from a series of 10 portraits of famous athletes that was commissioned by a collector from Andy Warhol. And they included Muhammad Ali, O.J. Simpson, Dorothy Hamill, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Willie Shoemaker, and some others. I just thought it was interesting that these were actually part of a commission that he did. And there are many examples of, I mean, this is a unique print, but he took many images of her before he selected one. And I wanted to move, this is meant to be a sort of transition into another theme. Jackie Kennedy, of course, is a tremendous icon, and if anything, made even more so by Andy Warhol himself, not that she needed to be made more of an icon. This is a very moving photograph, obviously taken at the time of the funeral of John F. Kennedy. But I also want to use it to sort of move to a slightly different theme about women being veiled. All right, and the relative power and lack of power in the notion of veiling of women. And so the next image is one by Manuel Alvarez Alvarez Bravo. It's called Temptations in the House of Antonio. It kind of fits with these biblical themes because, of course, it's referring to the temptation of Saint Anthony, the saint who was tempted by alluring figures and devils. It also is very much, and you'll see when you go up to it, it's an image of a nude woman standing under basically a clothesline with a sheet draping both before and behind her about halfway, and her hand is covering her crotch. And this, again, as an art historical evocation, refers both to Raphael Peale's image of Venus emerging from the bath, right? And to the Venus Pudica pose that is so famous in art. The next image is fascinating, and I don't know that much about this imagery. This is an image. You see this child, this tiny child, sitting on something, a chair. It's actually her mother, completely covered like a piece of furniture in a household with cats or something. I mean, she's just completely hidden. She not only is hidden, she becomes black. She drops out. She becomes an anti-presence, right? And there was a practical reason for this. Small exposure times of photographs like this were very long. And small children are notorious for not sitting still that long. And so basically, you had the mother shrouded, holding her child in a vice grips while someone took the photo. But, you know, and there are hundreds of these, if not thousands. It was a very typical sort of scene. This is from the 1870s. And, you know, I'd leave you to draw your own ideas about it, but I find it very eerie and very moving. And so I contrast that with the next image, which is by Georgi Zelma, who was a Soviet-Russian photographer. This is called Off With You, Chador, and it shows an Arab or a Muslim woman throwing off her veil. Very liberating, yes. This was a propaganda photo as the USSR was invading Afghanistan and Uzbekistan and those areas. And part of their claim to be to justify their invasion was that they were liberating women. And, you know, now we're in Afghanistan and we're liberating women by having them cast off their veils. I mean, so I wanted in this to bring out the thing we should always keep in mind when we're looking at art, that images that seem liberating and very positive can be being used actually for very propagandistic purposes in the service of all sorts of different ideologies. And of course, who's to say that casting off your veil is necessarily more liberating than being veiled? It's a whole other issue. And then moving into sort of from veiling into the veiling that is self-representation, that is, I think, an interesting mix of demonstrating power and demonstrating weakness. This is by Margaret Watkins. It's an advertisement for Woodbury soap. And I included it partly because I think it's a wonderful photograph, partly because, of course, soap, makeup, things like that become a new sort of veil for women. But she's also a very interesting figure who was basically an advertising photographer who was totally forgotten for a long time. She was from Canada. She moved to Scotland. And she left a box of 1,000 photographs to her next-door neighbor and told him to burn them when she died, which he didn't do in the time-honored tradition of people who don't burn Kafka's works and things like that. And then in the 1960s, Canada decided to honor her with a postage stamp. And she had a habit of taking gorgeous photographs of the dirty dishes in her sink. And so that's how that's the photograph they used. And there was huge controversy about this as being I'm not quite sure what the controversy was about, whether it seemed to dishonor her or whether it gave a bad example to housewives, whatever. But at any rate, I enjoyed that. And this moves into, and now I'm really going to start going quickly so I can concentrate on a couple works I really know about. This moves into Martha Wilson's work from a set of images in a group, in a folio called Femme Folio. And this is one that I was hoping that Karen might say a word about later on. But obviously, one of the series that she did was photographs in which she shows herself made up and coiffed and with earrings and in the guise that would be the most attractive if she were, for instance, on a book jacket cover or something like that. And then she shows herself in the most unattractive light that she can. And she obviously is contrasting. This is all about how how women live as facades, right? And what makes them desirable or not to a sort of imagined audience. The next, and actually, just one funny little thing. I looked up Femme Folio online, and the first thing that came up, let me see if that's what I have here. Yeah. Was the Femme Folio stand for iPad? the work at the end here I think is fascinating. This is another work I had not known before I was looking through this collection. It's by Suzanne McClelland. It's a letterpress printing. It has a wonderful texture because of that. It also has then been touched with pigment. It's called Pussy. And I put it up here because it's a little hard to see even when you're standing next to it. But she was inspired by a sort of propaganda poster backstage in a post office about how to be good to customers, basically, right? In fact, I'm not sure that I have the words. I don't. But at any rate, so this is, again, about how to put on a facade to make sure that you are accepted. I mean, it's very ironic, obviously. And so it says how to get along with people. And that was the sign that she saw. And it says, be interested in others, make cheerful promises, keep them faithfully, don't burden or depress those around you by dwelling on your minor aches and pains, right? All of these sort of bland platitudes. But then at the top it says, keep skid chains on your tongue. Ooh, right? So, I mean, there are some, and here, or love a guy. Treat him as a person of importance, right? So this is very biting. Quickly. Now, I want to move on to some of the worse and better of the power of women. And I'm going to start actually here, sorry, with the negative example. I thought just to be nice, I'd end on more positive one. Oh, by the way, on the table are more works that actually go along with the theme I've just been talking about. Miriam Shapiro's female court jester, well, just says court jester, but female court jester. Faith Ringgold's wonderful gouache of Marilyn Monroe, and Yasumasu fan with himself in drag as Marilyn Monroe in that famous calendar pose. I wanted to draw reference to one work of art here as well, which is, I don't know how many of you remember from, I think it was 1989, David Hammons, when at the time that Jesse Jackson was running for president, created this blue-eyed blonde image of Jesse Jackson scrawled with "How You Like Me Now," and put up a huge effigy of it in downtown Washington, D.C., and it caused quite a furor. Okay. So just to run along quickly, this is an engraving after an artist named Hendrik Holtzius, who was, along with Dürer, maybe Lucas van Leyden, probably the most revered printmaker of the 16th into the 17th century, before Rembrandt. I might prefer him to Rembrandt, but I might prefer him to Dürer. Well, wait till I get to this one. Anyway, and this is the creation of Eve, again, the worst day in history. I want you to look at this very carefully as a print, though, because this is the print whose technique I want you to contrast with Dürer's. In fact, maybe we should move the Virgin Mary over here when I'm done so people can do that. There's an earlier image by Holtzius here. This, by the way, was not engraved by Holtzius. This was engraved by Jan Harmansen Müller, but it's very much after Holtzius's design and style. This is an earlier work of his that is sort of a bridge in technique between the Dürer and this. But Holtzius developed a technique for expressing roundness of forms, the plasticity of forms, that was very intricate, very powerful, and I call it a fishnet stocking style, in which rather than using very straight lines and little hatchings and things like that, he creates this network of cross-hatching that swells and diminishes around and over the forms. And in some of his work, I wouldn't say this is the most like that, but in some of his work, it is impossible to believe that there isn't a body under fishnet stockings or something. I mean, it's incredibly eerie. And so I want you to look at also at the varying ways in which the darkest areas are created in these two works. They're quite dramatically different, I think. Another Adam and Eve, I show this to people whenever I have a chance because it's one of my favorite prints in the world. This is another artist I may prefer to some of the big names. Well, he's a big name himself, but Hans Sebald Bayem was called one of the little masters, because he worked in a very small scale, and a lot of his works are postage stamp, well, a little bigger than that, but you see, they're very small, and very detailed, and he has his own style that I would call somewhat pointillistic, like pointillisme, and so I urge you to think about that. This is a showstopper in our collection, wouldn't you say? This is by a woodcutter, an artist, also a painter, named Hans Schöfflein from Germany, early first quarter of the 1500s. And this is from, what, about 1530? Yeah. This is the story of Judith and Holofernes. It is most unusual in several ways. One is that it is made up of three different panels, because it was impossible to create a woodcut block of this size. Another thing that makes it remarkable is that it actually is all together here and in remarkably good shape, that something of this size and complexity would survive as long as it has. But another thing that is really fascinating is it's very unusual in that it not only shows Judith decapitating Holofernes. Holofernes was a general in Nebuchadnezzar's army who was attacking the town of Bethulia, which in Judea, which is where Judith's family lived. Judith was yes. Oh, I thought you raised your hand. Sorry. Judith was a widow who, when Holofernes was about to attack, said to her community, "Let me go out and meet with Holofernes, and I'll take care of the situation. Just don't ask me what I'm going to do." And she got all. She took off her widow's weeds and she put on her most seductive outfit and went with her servant with a lot of wine, and she wined and dined him and took him to bed, and he passed out and she cut off his head. Again, a very positive figure, a heroine. But scary, huh? All those kitchen knives, you know? What's unusual about this is that it tells the whole story. It's a continuous narrative that tells not just shows the incident of the beheading, which is what, or just right after the beheading, because it's in painting, it's the chance to show all the blood and gore of the blood spouting out of him. Yeah. But here, this begins with the seduction scene in which she is here with her servant, sitting at table with Holofernes and getting him drunk, and then they retire to his pavilion. And she cuts his head off, and the servant catches it in the bag to take it home, trophy. And then this is the ensuing battle in which the Israelites will defeat his leaderless army, right? And again, this is a marvelous example of a woodcut. It's a nice impression. Patrick pointed out to me that actually it's signed, and Schäufelein means little shovel in German, and so it's signed here with an H, basically for Hans, right? But inside the H is a little tiny shovel, tiny shovel. Kara Walker's, and now in the service of updating these tales to more contemporary times and issues. Kara Walker, this is one of, is it five? Five stills from a video or a little film that that Kara Walker, the contemporary artist, made of a puppet show, which she very much allows to be seen as a puppet show because you see her working the sticks in the background. And it is the story of a slave who basically seduces the slave owner so that he can be lynched by the slaves. So this is a real updating of the Judith and Holofernes story, right? And so I just show you, this obviously is a moment in which they kiss, and I could get into the racial politics, and I'm not going to. Nancy Sparrow, again from Femfolio. This is her Maypole War, and it basically is a pole with a lot of decapitated men's heads hanging off of it, flying around it. This is an image that she's done over and over again in different media, this sort of thing. And while originally it was mainly concerned, I think, with the war in Vietnam, it has morphed into being very much a reworking of the idea of female power. Alfredo Yar and Dianita Singh, this is from another portfolio for a human rights organization. It's from a folio of, I think it's 10 prints, Artists Support Witness. And one, of course, wonders what these women are looking at with such concern, and everyone who looks at it fills in that picture in a different way. But I liked the idea of the power of witness, of seeing and reporting on the atrocities, most likely, that are occurring either in war or everyday life. Singh is from India, and Yar is from Chile, both places where there have been horrible abuses of human rights. We've been listening very recently to the rapes going on in India. And so that's the power of that is why I left that there. And just for the very end, back here are some of those women who are being represented more positively. I thought that would be their power, all of them powerful, but represented more positively. It begins with a small woodcut, hand-colored, very old, from the Augsburg Bible. And while that was originally written in the late 1300s, this, I would say, is probably from 1450 or so? 1485. Okay. And it shows St. Helen, who was the mother of the Emperor Constantine, finding the true cross. She went on a mission to find the true cross in the Holy Land. She did some nasty stuff with some Jews in order to find out where the crucifixion had occurred. Had someone dig down, and of course Christ was crucified next to two thieves, and so there were three crosses. How do you choose? So they tested them out, and there was a passing corpse being taken to be buried, and they took one of the crosses and moved it, and nothing happened, and another, and moved it, and nothing happened, took the third one, moved it, and the guy sat up, lived again. She figured that was the right cross. Okay. So she was pretty powerful. This, I think, is wonderful. It's another Soviet picture to go along with Off With You, Chador. It's First Women on a Tractor from 1930, celebrating the Soviet, not only program of agriculture and the advances of the mechanized tractor and all of that, but women now, Rosie the Riveter doing this work. This is an odd thing, and I don't know if it has to do with powerful women or not. It's also by Hans Sebald Bayem. It's a woodcut this time, though. And it's one of a series of 12 patriarchs of the Old Testament and their wives. And the patriarchs of the Old Testament are represented from time to time, but their wives are never represented. And it's really enigmatic why this series was made, what the presence of the wives had to do with it. And I'm always trying to get students to work on these prints and learn more about them because they have not really been studied in any meaningful way. I just put that up. Here is a wonderful image of women as exemplars of something good. This is, again, Hendrik Holtzius, that sort of transitional print, of Orpah leaving Ruth and Naomi from the story of Ruth in the Old Testament. And Orpah, I can't remember now which was the mother. Who was older, Naomi or Orpah? Or Ruth. Anyway, two of them were the daughters-in-law of another. And they were extremely loyal to, I think it was Ruth. They were extremely loyal to their mother-in-law, Ruth. She was widowed, they were widowed, and they swore to stay with her for the rest of their lives, when normally widows would go back to their own families. And so these women set off with Ruth, and Ruth turned and said to them, "You deserve to be able to go back to your families. I let you free to do that, and with all the good feeling in the world." And one of them refused to go and stayed with her, the other went with the blessing of the other two to go back to be support for her own family. And it's often used as an example of faithfulness, loyalty, of goodwill, of all those good things. And so that's why I included here. And then finally, Ruth Morgan's Persenda, from another portfolio called The 10 by 10 Women, 10 Prints, 1995. And I just am dazzled by the self-possession of this young woman, her willingness to stare down whoever is, you know, in front of her, and then also by the learning, the power of learning that's being represented here, and the actual words, which include the how to use prefixes and things like that. And so it says, we'll add un-dis, you know, as in to diss somebody, but she's not being dissed, that's for sure. And then approve, turn, able, cover, like, make, kind, these strong words. And then this says escape from, and we can't see what. That's left enigmatic, but anyway. I've done enough. So, and please ask any questions. I'm sure I probably had some other. Did I have anything else? Oh, just the Nancy Sparrow, of course, is drawing upon Goya's Horrors of War series. So, thanks for.
Thank you.
So, the floor is open for everyone. Don't just ask questions of me. Ask them of each other. Oh, that's right. The one on the right is by Lewis Hine, who's a very famous photographer, largely of social issues and workers and things like that from the beginning of the 20th century. And it is of a Red Cross nurse working during war. And I didn't have space to put it up with the sort of positive role models. Very nice. The other is a photograph that has nothing to do with anything here, but I love the photograph, and it's by Margaret Bourke White, who, of course, was perhaps the most famous female photographer and one of the most famous photographers tout court of the 20th century. And it's of gold ingot bars drying after they were melted and formed in, I guess, Fort Knox. But it's these massive, it's like skyscrapers of industry, these upright, you know, erect, if I may say, bars of gold. And then there's this little old-fashioned GE fan going to, you know, cool them down. I mean, that's the sort of image of power, of the circular feminine fan finishing the gold ingots. Yeah, there you go. Karen, what would you add?
I could add a couple things that I happened to read Susan Smith's book on the power of women, Topaz, as well, and some time ago, because it came out in 1997, I believe. Mm-hmm. And one of the things she talks about, and these images were often like underneath the choir chairs and on the edges of the manuscripts and sort of behind the column kind of thing, not easy to see. So they were somewhat, you know, hidden. And the story there with, Alexandra and Aristotle, of course, different time periods, so they don't make any sense, but the idea of a wise man and his student, and that was the theme that she talks about, even within some artworks in China and such. So the story is like, many, many centuries it's gone on, and the idea is that Aristotle's saying if you spend your time with this woman, you won't learn anything, you know. So you shouldn't have a relationship, you know, and you should just stay a studious scholar, you know. And she has overheard this, and so she, the part of the, some of the images, she goes to a window, and of course the window is a symbol of this lust and many other symbols, but that's one of the things is this lust, and so she raises her skirt, and that raising of her skirt gets Aristotle all interested in her. So she says, this is like, you know, the overall story here, but she's like, says something like, well, you can come to my boudoir, but let's meet in the courthouse first. So then she tells Alexander, who she's in love with, to come to the same courtyard. And then in order for her to go up to the bedroom, she said, yes, but let me ride you, you know. So she does this, and so there's, images of these people looking over the edge, Alexandra, and here's this great wise man, and he has been, befallen to the Eve kind of, fallen to the temptress. And so in the story, so that's the story, but, and there's images for each part of that story in there, like I said, hidden around. But Susan Smith, and she refers to Christian de Pizan, who's written, I think it's the 11th or 13th century, it's some time ago, but...
The 1400s.
14, okay, I'm in the contemporary right there. And so even there, Christian de Pizan says, well, if women were doing the interpreting, the story would be understood differently. So one of the ways you could take that, you could say, look at how the evil temptress, okay, that's one, that's the way it's most often interpreted. But you could also say love wins out because they, Alexander and the woman, like, look how, even this wise man could get tempted, so, I can also have a relationship and study and it's okay, and so love wins out. And the other interpretation is that women in these kinds of circumstances take things into their own hands and they make change. Now, I've taken those three themes, and I've talked with that with my students in some of the classes, and they've thought about films, contemporary films, that still carry on mm-hmm. those three themes of the power of women. And I'm thinking about, if we look at some of these, and I'll just take the one that you sort of asked about, Martha Wilson, the second one over mm-hmm. there, to think about that idea of taking things into one's own hands, so calling attention to how we're represented. Or even the one over there
Ruth Morgan.
Ruth Morgan with the chalkboard behind her, and she's very strong there. Again, she's taking education or things into her own hands. So you could kind of take these themes. I was looking around trying to see where the love wins out kind of story is, and I don't actually see that in this particular selection.
Well, it begins with an era in which love was not supposed to win out. So that's what I was sort of following. I'm sure I could have found Love Wins Out.
Catholics don't marry for love.
That's right. That's right. Yeah.
And I might point out the Martha Wilson one, that she was a guerrilla girl. Guerrilla girls, the consciousness of the art world. So she very much involved. Martha Wilson, was founder and part of that Guerrilla Girl theme. So not only the imagery there, but we know her activism as really calling attention to the corruption of the art world, and that's what the Guerrilla Girls did. So so that's where I see women taking things mm-hmm. into their own hands. That's those themes.
Well, I suggest that everybody get up and look. And I'll stay here for a bit, and if you, let's see, yeah, I can stay for about 20 minutes, and if anybody wants to ask questions, come talk to me.
We're still contemplating doing the whole Hidden Mothers show.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
I don't know if I told you that before.
No, you didn't.
But it would probably be upstairs. It's just like 20, yeah. 30, like you say, there's 100.
Yeah, I was amazed when I actually...